Hi, my name's June, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
I really want to thank all of you and the committee for inviting me and giving me the privilege of being here this morning. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It has given me a life I never wanted, and it has made me a person I wouldn't have even liked when I came here. So it's been an absolutely fascinating journey for me. I really want to thank Dan and Claire for all their hospitality this weekend. You know, I've heard a lot of people refer to Southern hospitality, but I can hardly imagine anything that could be more than what these people gave of their weekend to show me and my daughters around. So I really appreciate it. Thank you. I also want to thank my friend Mike and Danielle and John for getting up really, really early to drive 3 miles past any links from Long Island to come out here and then take me and my daughter back to the airport today. So I really appreciate that. You know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, there wasn't a person in the world that would have accepted a collect phone call from me. There was no one left. And there was certainly no one who would have done the things that these people, Dan and Claire, who I hardly knew, did, and Mike, who I've gotten to know over the last couple of years. There wasn't anybody that was willing to make that drive to spend a little bit of time with me. So I think, you know, as it talks about in the book, we'll be amazed before we're halfway through. I don't know where the halfway point is. I don't know if I've passed it or not yet, but I have to tell you, I have been amazed with the things that have occurred in my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I do get asked to talk a fair amount, and when I do, I always try to start out by saying the very same things, because I think that they're the most important things that I'll say the entire time that I stand up here, however long that might be. And also I say that because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and sometimes even today, I have a fairly short attention span. I have to get back to thinking about me, so I don't always listen. I don't always listen to everything that's being said in the meeting. But for those of you who might be new or visiting, I start out by telling you the very most important thing that I will say today, and that is that I am not an authority or an expert on alcoholism, on Alcoholics Anonymous, or on anything else. I am just a member. I'm going to stand up here for a little while and share, as it suggests that we do in the big book, a little bit about what I used to be like, what happened, what I'm like today. I think that there's something else that's very, very important that if you're new or visiting that I hope you know about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, people come in, and Kathy referred to that, people come into Alcoholics Anonymous in a lot of different ways. I don't think it really matters how anybody gets into Alcoholics Anonymous. However, because people come in different ways, I think that sometimes it does get a little bit confusing about what part's Alcoholics Anonymous, who charges what, who do they pay, what's going on. So here's what I'd like you to know. Alcoholics Anonymous is absolutely free. Had it not been free, I never could have come here. Had it not remained free, I never could have stayed. I was over 10 years sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous before I could ever afford to put a dollar in the basket at the Seventh Tradition, and I haven't been able to do it all the time since then. So this is not about money. I feel very fortunate to have been born in a time when Alcoholics Anonymous exists. You know, my grandfather was the drunk driver, and he was killed along with the people in the car and in the other car when he was 46 years old. My father drank himself to death alone in a hotel room. My mother was to be in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous with varying lengths of sobriety for over 40 years. So it does seem, at least in my particular case, that alcoholism might have a genetic component. I don't know that that's necessarily certainly been proven or true, but it seems to run in my family. And when my mother and father and grandfather were born, Alcoholics Anonymous did not exist. Now, some of you, you know, you're probably not going to be all that interested in it, but I'm a little bit of a historical student, and I enjoy learning about these different things. And I was reading something and found out that, you know, when Alcoholics Anonymous began 75 years ago, Bill got sober. And that's Bill Wilson, in case for those of you who are new. Because, you know, I was at some people were at a coffee shop not too long ago and somebody said, you know, hey, who's this Bill Wilson guy people are always talking about? So I thought I'd make sure, you know, even though since you guys seem very service-oriented, I'm sure you guys have heard about that. But just in case there's someone new. So anyway, so Bill Wilson got sober. But he was sober for 6 months before he ever was able to have anybody else join in getting sober. And that became the second member, the co-founder, Dr. Bob. And when Bill and Bob got sober, I think that we forget sometimes, I certainly just, you know, take it for granted. I mean, they just didn't have, you know, a meeting directory. You know, they didn't get to pick what kind of meeting they wanted and where it was going to be. They didn't have a book. They didn't have any steps. And they didn't have any traditions. So what they had were two guys sitting in a room, and Bill had been sober for 6 months. And every one of us who's alcoholic knows what a big deal it is for an alcoholic to be sober 6 months. It's absolutely mind-boggling, you know. And they didn't know what was working. They weren't 100% sure what was working. Now, Bill had a lot of upset stomachs. He had a lot of ulcers, or imaginary ulcers, as he later writes. But anyway, he had problems with his stomach. So Bill would drink milk and sauerkraut. That was the tonic of the time, or it seemed to help. So as Bill and Bob worked with new people, since they didn't know if the milk and sauerkraut helped, they had the new people drink this. So I just want to, you know, when you guys are new here and you think that the old-timers are asking a lot out of you, you know, at least we're not doing that anymore. I got sober after the milk and sauerkraut thing. Anyway, I am a person who believes I was born an alcoholic. I do not want to have a philosophical discussion about that with anybody after the meeting. But there was something wrong with me before I ever started to drink. And I know today that, and I really didn't know this. I mean, it's kind of, you know, you kind of learn as we go along here, but that there was, you know, also a history of mental illness, you know, in my family, and just a lot of complications, you know, that were going on. But anyway, my first obsession in life was not alcohol. My first obsession in life was suicide. And again, if you're new or visiting, please know that I do not speak for Alcoholics Anonymous, that there are many people here who have come from a variety of different backgrounds that are alcoholic. I only am sharing my experience. And my first obsession in life was suicide. Now, I think about that, and I've thought about that many times, because as, you know, Dan mentioned, I have daughters, you know, and I have looked at these girls as they've been growing up, and it has hit me more and more as I have watched them grow up, how much pain I must have been in that I didn't even realize that from the time I was 5 years old, I began to try and kill myself. And I don't believe that there was a day that went by before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that I did not try and take my own life, put myself in a position where someone else would take my life, or pray to a God that I was slowly losing faith in to please let me die. I wanted out. You know, I talked at a meeting back home not too long ago at 26th and Broadway. Well, actually, it's probably been 10 or 15 years ago now. And this guy came up to me afterwards to thank me, mainly, I think, because his sponsor was standing behind him. And he said, you know, I want to thank you for your talk today. He said, I don't really believe it was your story, but I like the way you told it. And that's my favorite thing anybody's ever said to me after talking. And I think it was because I thought, wow, what a tribute to Alcoholics Anonymous that this man could doubt that I used to live the way that I used to live and act and feel the way that I used to feel, and that he could doubt that that's where I came from. You know, it's really remarkable. Anyway, I grew up in an alcoholic home, as you probably already guessed from the fact that I've mentioned my parents. There was a lot of violence in my home. There were a lot of broken promises in my home. There were a lot of things that go on in a lot of alcoholic homes. I'm an only child, and with the violence that was going on, I looked and I saw that the men won most of the fights. And When I was watching this group, I also noticed that, to my recollection, before coming to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't ever remember seeing a man cry under any circumstances. And I have seen men shot. I've seen them stabbed. I've seen their kids overdose. I've seen their wives leave them. I've seen a lot of things happen. I never saw a man shed a tear. And I thought that that meant that men didn't feel pain. And I looked at the women in my life, and I watched them go through those same experiences. And some of them were really tough, but most of them had a breaking point. Most of them broke down and cried at one or all of those different experiences. So I looked at those two different groups of people as I was growing up, and I decided immediately which one I wanted to be like. And when I was a little kid, they'd say, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" I said, "A boy." Now, it wasn't as easy to do back then as it is today. And that probably might have been kind of funny and cute if I'd said it once in a while, and then I threw in a teacher or a nurse every once in a while. But I was consistent about my answer, and it really began to concern my family. You know, plus I kept, you know, slashing my wrists and burning my body and beating myself with a hammer. So they had some concerns about me. And we were, I was raised Catholic. My mom began to take me to a priest for some counseling. And the priest told her that, because we were on welfare by then, that he could, that I could be seen by psychiatrists and psychologists. And I began to see some of those professionals, certainly not as many as lots of other members of Alcoholics Anonymous have seen in their journey. I saw some. I don't have any kind of a diagnosis to give you by these well-meaning professionals, because my feeling about those people was much like a good friend of mine, Patty Hicks, always did. I thought those people should have to work for their money, and I never told them anything. I never filled out one paper. I never answered any questions. I never played with one doll. I sat there the required 50 minutes, and when we were done, I got up and I walked out. And so I wasn't able to get any assistance. You know, I remember there was a line a few years ago in that movie, The Departed, you know, where there's this psychiatrist, and you know, she's talking to, you know, one of the Irish cops, and he says, you know, Freud said that the Irish are impervious, you know, to psychoanalysis, and you know, and whatever. And it's just kind of like, yeah, I mean, I'm just, you know, you don't ever say anything. You don't ever tell anybody anything that's going on. Now, when I was growing up and I watched these men in my life, who I realize today were almost all alcoholic, they seemed to be able to control their emotions. And that was the standard that I set for myself, was to be able to control my emotions so that the only emotion that I believed was acceptable was anger and rage. Now, I had a problem because I'm one of those people that I've heard Clancy refer to that seemed to be born without any insulation whatsoever for my emotions, so that absolute strangers could look at me funny and it hurt my feelings, let alone if somebody said anything. And if people teased me about being tall and skinny and this hair, you know, you can see, you know, people come up to me today and they say, "I was in your school." And I go, "Oh, really?" And they go, "Yeah, I remember your hair." I mean, you know, it's like, you know, so, and it was really, you know, it was something in when I was 5. But anyway, I had no sense of humor before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did not have a sense of humor about my hair for years after I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. So anyway, I was very sensitive, and everything hurt. And, you know, I found for me that alcohol made all the pain go away for a while. I am not one of those party girls. I do not have a lot of funny, wild, crazy stories to tell you about my drinking. I drank so that I didn't have to feel anything at all. And I'm extremely grateful that it worked that way for me. I really believe I would have had to been locked up in some kind of an institution had alcohol not worked the way that it did. Because life always, always hurt way too much for me. And I needed alcohol just to be able to take a little bit of a breath. And I learned as I lived out there, you know, in the world, that for me, I would much rather you punch me in the face than hurt my feelings. And you'll have to take my word for it. I became pretty good at getting people to either punch me in the face or want to, you know. And it was just a way of my trying to keep people away, you know. I began to drink on a regular basis when I was 8 years old. I had already been using drugs for about a year at that time. By the time I was 9, I was to mix that with other chemicals, barbiturates, reds, yellows, downers, whatever you might know them as, and alcohol. The combined effect of those got me exactly where I needed to go. I didn't want to feel anything. I didn't want to care. I didn't want to care about you, and I most certainly didn't want to care about me, and I hadn't for a long, long time. In my neighborhood, you know, I guess I've learned as I've gotten sober and traveled and gotten to meet lots of people in different areas, you know, that some things are geographical. I grew up in a beach town. I grew up in a town called Venice in Los Angeles. And if you're from Venice and you want to be a tough broad, which was my first lesson in acceptance when I realized I wasn't going to be able to be a guy, I had to settle for being a tough broad. So tough broads in Venice have tough feet. It's kind of a beach thing. You know, and I had the ability to walk down an alley with broken glass, barefooted. And I was extremely proud of this. And I would stand with my gang, because if you're going to be a tough broad, you need to be in a gang, and I was. And if you're in a gang and you're trying to be a tough broad, you need to do a lot of fighting, and I did. It's also important that I always try to remember, though, that I've never won a fight in my life. But I never fought less than 5 people at a time. My sponsor explained after I'd been sober, you know, if you fight one person and you lose, someone might think, you know, you're not very good. If you always fight groups of 5 or more, then they think, hey, she must be kind of tough, because how come that whole group had to take her on? You know, so you don't get challenged as much on, you know, how tough you are. But anyway, but you walk around with a black eye and a swollen lip all the time. But I would stand down there with my gang, and I would see touristy-looking people looking at us, and I would take my cigarette and I would throw it down on the sidewalk and I would put it out with my bare feet. And I would see those touristy-looking people whisper back and forth, and I knew what they were saying. They were saying, wow. That is one tough broad. And I was very impressed that I could do these things, you know. Yeah, after I'd been sober for a while, my sponsor said, you know what some of those people might have been saying to one another was, did you see that? That person just put flesh to fire. Why would anybody do anything so stupid? But I didn't know there was another way of looking at it. You know, it was just, you know, it was just kind of the way. My mother, as I mentioned, was to be in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for many, many years. My mom is sober today. Sometimes I forget, you know, to mention that. And she celebrated 5 continuous years of sobriety this past July. It's a great thing. It's interesting, you know, John and I were chatting just a little bit before the meeting, and I was telling him that, you know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would never have believed when they would sit in meetings and they would say, you know, if you're sitting here and you're sober and you're taking care of yourself and you're eating and you're sleeping and you have not had any alcohol, you do not even realize that the disease of alcoholism is continuing to progress and get worse and worse. I would have thought, well, that just makes no sense. Just thought, that's just crazy. That just makes no sense. You've got to be doing better. Because, you know, the people that drink the way I did, and maybe the way some of you did, they don't eat, they don't sleep, they don't, you know, do anything but drink. So you got to be in better health when you've been sober 6 months, 5 years, a year. I mean, you know, it's got to be different. And when I was a kid, my mom got sober at one point. And she was coming up, I can't remember now whether it was 1 year or 2 years, but I remember that we were living in an apartment with the gas, the lights, and the phone all on. Something that never happened when my mom was drinking or when I was drinking. So it was a big deal. And my mom came home one night, and she was all dressed up. And she said, you know, tonight I had a glass of brandy. And I said, really, Mom? I said, I thought when you go to that AA thing, you don't drink anymore. She said, this was brandy. This was a very elegant party. Okay. Now, my mom drank in bars in Venice Beach, which were kind of like biker bars or, you know, just really rough bars. You know, I mean, like a pool cue through the head, you know, was like something that happened, you know, on a weekly basis. This was the kind of bars my mom drank in. So brandy, you know, was kind of a different deal with like a glass and stuff, you know. So I kind of got that, you know, different. She's dressed up. It was different. So anyway, I went to school the next day. And when I came back, I walked in the apartment and there were all kinds of people. Men and women passed out in the apartment. There were bottles all over the apartment. That night, one of the guys broke in the room and attacked me, and I was yelling for help, but nobody woke up, and I finally managed to get out of the apartment and run out. And when I came back a little bit later the next morning, My mom had come too, and she introduced me to her new boyfriend, who she had met the day before, who had just gotten out of prison that day for killing his girlfriend. I mean, we were, in 24 hours, we were back as far as alcoholism had ever taken us, you know. And so I've always been able to remember that when they tell me that my disease has continued to progress, even when there's been a long time in between drinks. I was brought to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous eventually by my mother, not because I asked for help, not because I wanted help, not because I admitted having a problem, but because she thought if she left me alone, I might get her evicted from another apartment. I went into that meeting and I didn't raise my hand because I wasn't an alcoholic. And even if I had been, I wouldn't have joined an organization that was allowing my mother to belong to it. You know, by the time I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the only person I hated more than my mother was me. And I hated my mother for everything that had ever gone wrong in my life. And take it from me, the short version, a lot had gone wrong. And so I was filled with anger and hatred, and I just sat in that meeting with my arms folded. But there was a guy at that meeting that I admired more than anybody else in the world. And again, if you're new or visiting, please remember that this is my own experience. This is not an experience that would be common for everyone in Alcoholics Anonymous. But there was a guy in that meeting that I admired more than anybody else in the world. And I admired him for a lot of reasons that you may not identify with. But this was a guy that was from my hometown. He was from Venice. He was actually a drinking friend of my mother's. And you know, if I had had to tell you in one sentence what I wanted out of life before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, the only thing I can think of as I look back that I might have said I wanted the ability to walk into a room full of strangers and have everyone there back away from me in terror. Now, when you're 87 pounds, that almost never happens. But this guy, Paul, who was a drinking friend of my mother's, I'd seen him in those really rough bars that my mom drank in. And if Paul had been drinking and he wanted to sit at your table, you gave him the table. You didn't try and say, hey, Paul, there's two empty tables over there. Because you didn't know what Paul was going to do to you to get that table. You just gave it to him. And so I looked at this man who had achieved everything that I wanted out of life, the ability to clear a table in a really tough bar, and he was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it made a big impression on me. I did not get sober then. I drank again the next night, and then I came back to some meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I still didn't raise my hand, and I didn't talk to anybody except Paul, because he was the only person that I considered cool enough to talk to. And when Paul and I would have these conversations in between the meetings, I explained to him that I wasn't an alcoholic, that I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic, that I wasn't anything like my mother, who we all thought was so alcoholic. I explained to Paul that I was too young to be an alcoholic. I had places to go, people to see, things to do. I had my whole life ahead of me. And I may have a problem with some other things, but certainly I was not alcoholic. And Paul turned to me and he said, you know, of course by then later on I found out that non-alcoholics don't have to spend any time convincing other people they're not alcoholic. You know, they already know that. But Paul turned to me and he said, you know, June, I'm pretty new in AA right now this time. And he said, and they've told me I can't diagnose anybody's disease but my own. He said, but in your case, I'm going to make an exception. I've seen the way that you drink and the way that you mix it with chemicals, and I happen to believe if you don't come into this program and take what these people have to offer you, within a period of 6 months or less, you're going to be on the streets, you're going to be shooting stuff, and you're going to be selling your ass. And I knew he wasn't trying to make up some story like somebody might do in high school. He was just talking about facts. He was just talking about things that had happened in his life, things that had happened or were beginning to happen in mine. And I thought a little bit about what he said, but I did not want to join Alcoholics Anonymous. I was not excited about that at all. And yet in that two-week period of time, absolutely every option but Alcoholics Anonymous was removed from my life. As I mentioned before, I was filled with hatred, most of all for myself. Tons for my mom, and it kind of trickled over to everybody else in the world. I did not like women. I didn't like any women. I didn't like sitting next to women. I did not shake hands with women. I most assuredly did not hug women, and I did not like listening to women speakers, which always makes me feel good because I know there's never as many people listening to me as it looks like. You know, the men that I had known in my life were pretty much alcoholics. They were pretty much all extremely violent. Saw the guys in AA, they were saying they were alcoholic. I figured that's how they were too, and I didn't like them either. So I had a problem, because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, all they had were men and women. I didn't like any of them. But I went to 21 meetings a week most of the first couple years that I was sober. And I had a commitment at almost every one of those meetings. You know, and I believe, in case I, you know, get sidetracked, and I'm sure I will, because that always happens to me, but I do believe that service, singularly, was one of the very most important gifts that I was ever given, and it was really the foundation that changed everything, you know, in my life. And it is also something that I have been able to consistently believe in throughout the struggles or times of doubt that I have experienced in the years that I have been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, so I got those commitments. I didn't get those commitments because I was trying to get a gold star in AA. I didn't think this was going to work. I'd listen to those old timers and they'd say, you know, the next time I come speak at this group next year, half of you won't be here. And I always thought they meant me. I always thought I'll never make it. I'd never made anything. I'd never gone to school a week, 5 days in a row in my life. So I was not thinking I was going to make it. And yet I thought, you know, maybe if I try 110 times harder than every other new person in here, maybe I'll get to stay a while. I don't know. And, you know, it was sort of a weird thing because I wasn't really all that excited about staying. You know, it wasn't like I thought, I'll stay. And, you know, I was talking with Danielle about this before. It wasn't like I thought, I'll stay and I'll get a good life. You know, I didn't believe that. Not for a minute. But I'll tell you what I believed, and this is so interesting. I've thought about it more and more, and it's one of the reasons that I take a plane and I fly across the country when I'm asked to do this. Because a lot of people went to a lot of meetings when they had a lot of better things to do, and they shared, and they touched my heart. And they touched my heart in a way that I think is really profound, because I was unable and unwilling to let almost anyone get near me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I mean, I had a bad attitude. I didn't like me and I didn't like you. I didn't like people sitting next to me and I didn't like people touching me. But the people in Alcoholics Anonymous that I heard share at the podium, they touched my heart, even though I couldn't let anybody get near me. And I believe that maybe that is the language of the heart. You know, I believed that if I stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous and I tried everything that these people were talking about, because I knew that they had experienced pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I'd been on the streets long enough. I could read people. I mean, I certainly wasn't an expert. You know, there's lots of people better than me. But I knew that these people had suffered. I knew what alcoholism had done in their life. And I knew that they were doing better. I knew that something had happened here. But I believed not that I could be like them and have a good life or walk down the sunny side of the street as some of them talked about, or, you know, look in a mirror or look at someone in the eye and, you know, have my self-respect. I didn't believe any of that. I'd never had any self-respect and I wasn't expecting to get it here. But what I hoped was that maybe one day as I walked down the street and I happened to glance in one of those storefront windows, which is the closest I ever planned on being to looking in a mirror, maybe I wouldn't feel like throwing up anymore at who I was or where I came from. And that was enough hope to keep me coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous, that someday I wouldn't feel like throwing up at how I lived and where I came from. So I got these commitments, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous at those 21 meetings a week. A lot of them were speaker meetings, and a lot of these people, as I said, they showed up in the rain. They drove a long way. They left their families and their dinners and their holidays, and they came and they showed up. And a lot of them made me laugh, and I hadn't laughed in a long, long time, and I hadn't seen anything funny in a long time. And probably, you know, a sense of humor that I've been given here in Alcoholics Anonymous is probably one of the greatest gifts also, and the ability to laugh at myself. And I really encourage you to try and find a sponsor or a guide that can make you laugh at yourself. Because it's really helpful, you know, on this journey, I'll tell you. Thank you very much. I was thinking of asking for another drink. Thank you. I got very active in Alcoholics Anonymous from the very beginning, and I got active in a group. The Monday Night Venice group was very active in service. And we were to learn a lot about the traditions and a lot about service. And I feel really lucky that was my foundation, and I try to pass that on to the people that I am fortunate enough to work with or sponsor. Where am I going to go? You know, when I came into the program, I had a very limited vocabulary, consisted almost solely of profanity. There were a few exceptions, the and mother. And I found a lot of people who were very offended by that type of language, so I tried to use it more when they got near me. I didn't wear shoes most of the first couple years that I was sober. I mean, it wasn't like I took them off to go to the meeting. I mean, I just didn't wear them. So I didn't wear them to the meeting. I didn't wear them anywhere else. I wore motorcycle chains on my wrists and my ankle. I had a motorcycle jacket, and on the back it said, "Do unto others, and then split." It was my own spiritual philosophy. I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day. Back then you could smoke in the meeting. And I lit all of them myself. Occasionally someone would hold a match for me, and I let them hold it as long as they liked. But they never lit my cigarette with it. Sometimes someone would hold a door open for me, and I'd let them hold it until their arm got tired. And then I'd open it for myself only, and I'd go through the door. And of course I look back, and I know what I was really trying to say was that I don't need you, I don't need anybody, I don't need anything, I'm fine by myself. Of course, you know, those of us who've been here a while, we know that no one who's doing all that well by themselves ever comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, so I wasn't really fooling anybody, you know. After I'd been sober a short period of time, I took up smoking cigars and then a pipe. And what I want to let you know is that I was able to sit in some fairly large meetings that we have back in Los Angeles and have an entire row all to myself. I was pretty good at keeping people away. I didn't ask for rides. I mostly hitchhiked. I walked. I took a bus if I had enough money. Occasionally, you know, I would take a ride. But I didn't want to listen to their AA crap, so I, you know, usually didn't take the ride. Because, you know, I really just wasn't very open-minded about this whole thing. And I thought if they had a car, I didn't like them. We'd never had a car. And I figured, I mean, that's the kind of thing I could do. I mean, I could, you know, I could eliminate a whole group. You got a car? I don't like you. We never had a car. You know. And I'll tell you, it was interesting. A few years ago, I don't know how many now, but my home group is a really... I have 2 home groups, by the way. The Thursday night Brentwood Workshop, which is one of the older meetings in Los Angeles, and the Sunday noon Ohio Street group, which I encourage you to invite you to come out and attend if you're ever out there. But my home group, the Thursday night Brentwood group, is a question and answer meeting. I know Max has been there, and you know a few of you probably have been out there. But that particular meeting, one night, this guy was talking. I don't even remember who it was, but he was talking about being an egomaniac. Now, the minute anybody ever talked about being an egomaniac throughout my life, I just, you know, I figured, well, I don't identify. Because, you know, that wasn't my problem. You know, I always hated myself. I hated everything about myself. I hated, you know, having curly hair. I hated being tall. I hated being skinny. I hated being from Venice. I hated everything. So, you know, egomaniac, not really my deal. But this particular guy, he said, you know, an egomaniac is not necessarily someone who thinks well of themselves. I thought, really? That's what I always thought it was. He goes, it's not even necessarily someone who thinks often of themselves. He said it's simply someone who thinks only of themselves. I thought, oh, okay, so I actually was a tremendous egomaniac, because when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was one of the worst snobs you will ever encounter, because I judged everyone, and I knew they had not suffered the way I had. They didn't come from the alleys in Venice. They didn't come from my streets. They didn't come from my background and the things that had happened in my life. So they hadn't suffered. They didn't know pain, you know. And again, I was able to eliminate, you know, this whole group. And I got a sponsor, which still fascinates me tremendously, because it was a woman. And, you know, whenever I think about my sponsor, Gail Wilson, I think about what it talks about in the book when it says, we are people who normally would not mix. And that would be Gail and I. Now, Gail was probably almost 3 times my age. She was from the South. I hated people from the South. She had a loving family that was still married. You know, I'd been through a bunch of foster homes. I hated people with loving families. You know, she had traveled. She'd been a stewardess. She'd run all around the world. You know, I ran away once from Venice hitchhiking. I made it 3 miles east to Culver City, and that was as far as I'd ever been before I got sober. So, you know, I didn't like people who traveled. And She not only did not use the same kind of language that I used, she didn't know what a lot of the words I was using meant, you know. And as if all of that was not enough, and I really think it was, she had been seen on numerous occasions in public wearing pink. Now, I didn't even sit in a row with someone who wore pink until I was like 10 years sober, just in case they thought I was a girl. You know, it's like, just, I'm not sitting with pink. So, anyway, Gail became my sponsor. And after a few years, or maybe a year or two, I guess, yeah, a couple of years, Gail began to sponsor another woman, a pink woman. Linda, pink and blonde and beautiful, truly one of the most beautiful women I have ever seen before or since. Now, if you were in a meeting standing next to Linda, you could get trampled by all of the guys who were welcoming her to AA, you know. So Gail begins to sponsor Linda, and I'm okay with, you know the sponsor is going to sponsor more than one person. I don't have a problem with that. That's fine. She can sponsor whoever she wants. But now Gail wants me to become friends with Linda. I'm like, she doesn't need a friend. You know, you can look at her and see she doesn't need friends. I don't want to be her friend. We have nothing to talk, nothing in common. And this is just, this is not, you know, this is carrying this whole AA thing way too far. And finally, Gail got really mad and slammed the table. And she said, "Has it ever occurred to you that it hurts exactly as much to want to kill yourself in a hotel room in Paris as it does in an alley in Venice?" I thought, well, no, that had never occurred to me. And I began to sort of see some of that, and Linda and I became friends, and Linda is one of my dearest friends today, and we laugh a lot about how many different adventures and journeys that we have shared along the way. And again, learning about the language of the heart, you know, that this isn't necessarily about where we come from on the outside. You know, it's kind of like what was going on in here. So anyway, I would stand at one of the groups that I had. My commitment was greeter, and I would stand there barefoot with my motorcycle chains and jacket and cigar welcoming the newcomers as they came to AA. Sometimes I'd hear someone whisper to them as they walked by, "You see, if you keep drinking, you can end up like that." Those people who did not know how old I was, when I came to AA, as I mentioned, my mom had been around AA for a very long time, and so a lot of people knew me and her because of that. But the other groups that I mostly went to who didn't know who I was or how old I was, they were guessing my age at the time as 37. I was 13 at the time. And I'll tell you, I don't know when the, you know, thing is going to, like, cross over or whatever, but I'm standing up here this morning. I have been sober 38 continuous years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have to tell you, I feel at least 1,000 years younger, and I have for a long time, than I did when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was so old when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous that you either know what I'm talking about or you don't. And there was no one here, not all of them put together, that could have convinced me that someday I wasn't going to feel that way. I just didn't believe it was possible. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had dropped out of school. I have a seventh grade education. My sponsor, Gail, wanted me to go back to school. I was not willing, I was not able, I wasn't even wearing shoes. You know, you can see I tried a few different schools, it didn't work. And she was very disappointed. But she told me, you know what, if you're not going to go get a high school education, then you're going to get the kind of jobs that people can get with seventh grade educations, and that's what I did. And those jobs were flexible, they allowed me to get to lots of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did that. Eventually, when I was a couple years sober, my sponsor Gail found a program for me. It was like a vocational, you know, program to train, and she signed me up, and I went over there, and it was a program to learn how to be an office worker, be a secretary. Now, if there's anything in my life I never wanted to be, I just want to mention in case you didn't get this, you know, from the gist of my story, it was an office worker and a secretary. So I started out there, I was typing like 17 words a minute with 9 errors. I stayed there for like 14 months. At the end of that time, I was typing, 37 words a minute with 19 errors, and they said, hey, you're not gonna make it as a secretary. I thought, I could have told you guys that before we started this whole deal, but they said, you can probably go out and get a job in an office doing some of the other skills that you've learned here. So now I had to go out and look for a job, and I'm a couple years sober, and this was one of the hardest experiences that I had, except for the court cases and the deportation hearings and being thrown out of the state of California, but that's a whole other story. That was in sobriety. Okay, so anyway, I was like, it was really hard to go out and go to these job interviews, and I was not wearing shoes regularly. Some women on the program took me out, and we went over to like the Goodwill and stuff, or they gave me stuff. And I put these clothes on, and it was like, hey, look at the little Venice Bride in the citizen costume. It just didn't feel right, And so I went out on these many, many job interviews talking to these citizen-y type people. And I just, didn't get a job. And then finally I got a job. And it was so square. It was in the insurance company. I thought, oh, my sponsor is going to love this. They love that sort of thing. So I went to work. I worked really hard. And on the seventh day they called me in the office. I thought they probably wanted to give me a raise. And they said, I'm sorry, we're going to have to let you go. They said, you don't have enough experience for this job, and not only that, you don't seem to have any common sense whatsoever. Now, I didn't really know what common sense was, but I knew I was being insulted. And I went downstairs. Now at that point, I'm 2.5 years sober, I think, and I've been going to 21 meetings a week, and I'm not good at math because I dropped out of school in seventh grade, but you can see that's a lot of meetings. I did not ever remember in any of those meetings ever hearing of anybody sober being fired. And so I went downstairs and I called central office and I reported that company. And I thought, we'll pick it. Sober AA member fired. I mean, we're not going to stand by and let things like that happen. And that's kind of what they did. They just kind of laughed, and they sent somebody over to pick me up so I could volunteer at central office for a few hours. How did that help? So now I had to go out and look for a job, and now I'm looking for a job, and I've been fired, and I'm dressing up in my citizen costume and going out, and applying. And this woman on the program from my group, she called me up, and she said, they're hiring at a bank downtown. I'd never even been in a bank. I'd never been downtown. So she drove me downtown to interview for this bank. Now, when you're talking to the bank, people, it's necessary at a bank employee that you get bonded. So they say this, they go, look, it says on the application, we're going to have to do a thorough background investigation because you're a bank employee. But, I don't want anybody checking into my background. I had a history of being a thief. I'd been stealing longer than I'd been drinking. I didn't really like the idea of people looking into my background. Even after I got sober, they used to talk about it in my home group. It was really important that you get the big book. You got to get the big book. We'll sell you the big book. It doesn't, whatever it costs us, that's what we sell it for. We're not trying to make any money. You got to get the book. And they'd say at my group, not at all the groups, if you don't want to talk to us about it or you're too scared to talk to us about it, you just go ahead and steal it. Well, like I said, stealing was, like a way of life for me. But I sort of was kind of superstitious. So I thought if I steal it from my group, I could jinx my sobriety. So I'd gone to the library and I stole the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous from the library. And while I was there, I stole a copy of the 12 and 12. A lot of people talked about that. I thought that might be a good book too. And at this point, I had it begun on my amends. I'd gone down to the local librarian and returned those books along with a lot of other great classics like Misty the Seahorse I'd been stealing all these years. And I'd had to explain to her, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I need to return these books. I said, but I'd like to make payments, because they want like 3 to 5 cents a day. I'd had some of the books, for like 10 or 11 years. I don't know how long I'd had them. And she said, this is so funny. She said, I used to work in a library in Laguna Beach. This man came in, he brought the big book in, and, he'd done the same thing. She says, I guess you guys do this all the time. So, whatever. So anyway, I'm sitting in the bank and I'm thinking, they call one library and I've had it, But I went ahead and I filled out this application and they called me back a couple days later. And not only did I get hired to work in a bank, they put me to work in the vault. Yeah, that was my reaction. And I'll tell you, I did not even know if AA worked that well. And I suppose it would make a much better AA talk if I could tell you it never for a moment crossed my mind to steal a single thing. But that would not be my story. But I can tell you that I did not steal a single thing while I worked there. And that amazes me, you know, from where I came from. Anyway, during that time that I was working at the bank, I began to take a class at night. They actually referred to it at the city college that I went to as the dummy English class. Because I used to be able to read, and I could read words, but I couldn't hold the whole idea, a whole sentence in my mind and have it mean anything. And even after I was a couple years sober, and I began to think, and I'm sure a lot of other people thought that maybe I had done something, you know, to my brain that wasn't going to be able to be fixed. But I thought if I took this dummy English class, maybe I could learn how to keep ideas in my head again. And I went ahead and I took that class at night. And then I took a couple of other classes and ended up getting laid off at the bank. And I got an opportunity to get a job at the school working in the cafeteria and another job working in the library. And then I had a job cleaning apartments on the weekends. And I began to go to school full time. And, you know, along the way, I'd come up with this dream. I don't know when I had it or where I got it. But I went ahead and I came up with this dream, and my sponsor, Gail, told me, you know, if you have a dream, you got to do the same footwork anybody in or out of AA has to do to make a dream come true. And so I went ahead and I began to do that footwork. And after I finished, they called me in. They told me I'd completed all the requirements for what they called an AA college degree. So that was a nice name for a college degree. I never planned on getting a college degree. And of course, at that time, I took this test that they called a GED to get an equivalency to a high school diploma. And I went ahead and applied to a university, and I got accepted at a university, and I went ahead and continued to work those different part-time jobs and waitress and, you know, do whatever I could to support myself and go through school. And I ended up finishing at the university, and I did some more footwork for my dream, and I got a telegram, and it's been over 20 years ago now, telling me that I was chosen as one of 300 out of 3,000 applicants to go to law school. Now, I'll tell you, I always planned on spending a lot of time in court. But never on that side of the table. And I have a job today where I really believe I'm able to be of service. And I have a job today where I have never once gone to work, and I am not reminded of where alcoholism takes people like me. I feel very fortunate. And, you know, it's sort of interesting. I've been doing this job. It's the only job that I did one other job as a lawyer, and I really hated it and thought I was going to go back, honestly, to waitressing. It was so awful. But anyway, this job I love, and I feel like I have a talent and I'm able to be of service, and I like it. And after I'd been there, I think about 10 years, I'm not really sure, my boss called me in the office, and he said, you know, we would like to have you be involved in our training. We want you to train the new lawyers that we're bringing in because we like your attitude. And I thought, you know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1972, who'd have ever thought I'd get a job for my attitude, you know? Well, I want to jump around a little tiny bit and then finish on time and all that. So let's see, where will I jump to? Well, I think I'll jump briefly to my daughters. I have three daughters, and I still find that, you know, interesting. I was even talking to them about it the other day because, first of all, I never believed I would have any children, never wanted to, because I hated everything about me, and I couldn't even imagine why I'd want to bring forth anybody who could be remotely like me into a world that I thought was just a terrible, terrible, painful place. So what would be the point? So it was really not even something that was on my list, certainly, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous or for a long time after. And then when I did finally decide that I was going to try and have children, I sort of always figured if I did have children, I'd have boys because I'd know how to be a man. or I thought I did, you know what I mean? But I'm like, what would I tell these girls? And it's been, like, unbelievable. You know, they know way more about makeup and curling hair and pink. Apparently, pink can skip a generation. We had a lot of pink, you know, in my life. But we've had a lot of interesting and fun journeys, and they've certainly taught me, I think, way more than I've taught them. And here's something kind of interesting that I've been learning in the last couple of years. I think that I had hoped that by getting sober, when I got into the program and I really decided I'd made this commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had hoped, and I periodically find myself falling into the belief that by staying sober and trying to live my life as best I can by some of the spiritual principles that are suggested here, that I will then have like an imaginary shield from anything bad happening in life. This is what I would like. I think that would be fair, but it hasn't been my experience at all. And it frequently kind of shocks me, that I am going to be subjected to regular life issues, when I'm in AA. I mean, come on, I don't drink. I mean, how much can the world ask? So my experience has been very much that life has continued to happen in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for me and for lots of other people that I care about. But here's one of the little things that that was happening with my daughters. A couple of years ago, one of them was scheduled to graduate from high school. Now, this was a very big deal, because as you probably heard when I mentioned, I did not go past seventh grade. Actually, I have to say, even though I don't really have any particular credit for it exactly, but all three of my daughters have gone past seventh grade, and I'm very happy about that. So, but now we're coming up on the first high school graduation, and I'm very excited about this. And then I get this letter that says, your daughter may not be allowed to graduate. Now, I'm thinking, well, this is a mistake, and I'm looking at it and I'm reading it and I'm thinking, how can that be? I go to AA. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I have taught her, you show up, you do the best you can. I mean, what is going on here, and I was just shocked. How is that going to fit into my talk? My daughter, and we got the whole thing. I mean, we're graduating. We got the cap, the whole thing. I mean, I'm like thinking what I'm going to wear for the picture. And I started to realize, Alcoholics Anonymous does not guarantee me that my kids are going to graduate from high school or that my kids are going to go to college or anything else. That's their journey. She's on her journey. Each of my kids, they have bumps in their road. They're going to make mistakes. Hopefully they won't be too big, but if they are, they're going to have to pay the consequences. That's all. Alcoholics Anonymous only allows me to show up if there is a graduation, Because as an alcoholic, if you're the kind of alcoholic that I am, once I'm drinking, you can't count on me for anything. I might show up, and you might be sorry I did. Or I might not show up, which is probably more likely, But Alcoholics Anonymous, it allows me to show up if there is something, I have a daughter who's she's playing soccer for a school in Connecticut. And Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me to go to lots and lots of soccer games. It's allowed me to get up at 5:30 in the morning and drive her to lots and lots of soccer games so that she could get the training and the competition so that she could get on and, be invited to play for this school team. And it's a wonderful thing that I've got to see. But Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't guarantee that everybody's kid is going to go play soccer. She did that. She got up at 5:30 in the morning. She trained. She did the stuff. She showed up. I only get to be there and be a part of it. And that's a big deal. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. I think that, I want to go ahead and I guess I'll share this this one other kind of story, and then I'm probably getting pretty close to sitting down. Again, in that same way, there have been different times, in my life where I've felt like I'm in a dark hallway. And I don't think that anybody maybe goes through life, or maybe very few people go through life without having a few dark hallways. I've been very fortunate in Alcoholics Anonymous that there have been people who are maybe sometimes standing at the end of the hallway saying, keep walking. like when I'm back there going, why? Or they make me laugh so that I keep showing up, you know. And some incredible things have happened in my life because I didn't drink and I showed up. So one of the things I'd like to share is if you happen to be in one of those dark hallways, you know, you don't have to drink to start over. You know, you don't have to drink to go find someone in Alcoholics Anonymous who can be a guide for you. Because I've been very fortunate that so many people have touched my life in so many different ways. Some of them I don't even know their name. I've listened to their CD while I'm driving, you know, around after I'm while I'm waiting to pick up my kids in the car, you know, and they've changed my life. So I'm going to tell you at least this story, and then we'll see what I do. When I was about 10 years sober, I was graduating from law school. It became very clear that year that my sponsor, Gail Wilson, who was 48 years old, was dying of cancer. I spent a lot of time in the hospital with Gail, as much as I could in those last couple of months. And we talked a lot about things. We talked a lot about how, you know, when I was new and how she would, you know, frequently see me at her home group, the Thursday Night Brentwood group, and ask me not to sit next to her because she couldn't take the cigar smoke. And she also asked me before I walked away to please not tell anyone that she was my sponsor, you know, which was fine with me because, you know, I told you I was kind of embarrassed to hang out with someone lame like her. But we were sitting in the room and, you know, we were talking about, you know, like, Gail, you know, why would you even become my sponsor? And she said, you know, I'll tell you why. There's only one reason, because I was taught never to say no. She said, when you asked me to be your sponsor, she said, I knew you'd never make it. She said, I knew with your background and your attitude, there was no way. She said, but I was told to not say no to an AA request. And she said, and you have to be one of the biggest flakes I have ever sponsored. She said, you know, you have a horrible job history. You know, you were horrible, you know, with your dating choices. You know, it was unbelievable the things that, you know, I had to live through watching you. You know, she said it was just, you know, remarkable. And she said, you know, but I was told to not say no. She said, I remember when you called me and you told me you were going to take a class at school. She said, I knew you'd never finish. You'd never finished anything. The only thing that you ever did in all the years that I sponsored you consistently was you showed up for your AA commitments. But other than that, there could not have been a bigger flake in every area than that. And she said, and then you called and you said, I'm going to take a class. And she said, I just think, you know, she's not going to do it. But then you finished. She said, and not that long after you were taking those classes, you called me up one day and you said, Gail, you know what? I think I know what I want to do. I think I want to go to law school. She said, I had to force myself not to laugh out loud. I mean, you know, it's like 8 years of college. You know, you hadn't had a job that lasted 6 months, you know. So she hadn't made it a semester yet, you know. And she said, but I didn't say anything. And what we talked about was, why didn't she say anything? Why didn't she say, hey, what are you, nuts? I mean, look at where you're from. You know, look at your education. What are you thinking here? Get those crazy ideas out of your mind. Do something practical. Just stop it. But she didn't say anything. And clearly, what we talked about was that Gail never believed in June. Gail never thought June was going to amount to anything. But Gail always believed in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she'd seen things happen here that she didn't quite understand how or why they happened. And that's why she didn't say anything to me. Gail did pass away that year. I went on to graduate in May. She died in April. I graduated in May. And then in order to be a lawyer, in case you didn't know this, I really didn't, because I didn't really know any lawyers. I knew one lawyer in the program, Clint Hodges. But you have to pass the bar exam in order to practice law. So this is a, you know, very long, intensive experience. It's a 3-day test in California, 24 hours, 8 hours a day. And so I went ahead to study for this test, and I did everything that I've been taught to do. I showed up. I did all the work I could possibly do. I kept my AA commitments as best as I could. I, you know, did everything you're supposed to do. And I showed up, and I took the test 24 hours. Now, by the time the test results are coming out, it's Thanksgiving. So you take the test in July. You have to wait 4 months to find out how you did. So now it's Thanksgiving weekend and the test results are coming out, and I get my letter and I open up my letter and it says, we regret to inform you that you did not pass. Now, I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was another one of those things. It was like, well, wait a minute. I mean, I'm sober. You know, I go to meetings. I did all the right things. I studied all the things they said. I showed up. I borrowed money to pay for the stupid test. you know. And right now, it's about to be December 1st, and I have enough money in my bank account to pay my rent for December. And that is it. So I'm 11 years sober almost. I don't have a dollar to put in the basket. I'm supposed to speak that night at a meeting. Now, I cannot think of another time that I wanted to go less to show up. But I went ahead, I showed up, you know, no idea what I said. I'm sure I just stood up there and sobbed and, you know, inspired thousands of newcomers. You know, I mean, you know, like, hey, you know, keep coming back, 11 years. You know, you too cannot have a dollar. It's a great program, you know. And I end up, you know, like later on that week, central office calls and gives me a 12-step call. And I had to borrow money for gas for my little Volkswagen Bug, and I go pick up this woman, and she's drunk, of course. You know, that's the best way to go to your first meeting, really. And we go to the meeting, and then after the meeting, we come back to my apartment, and we're, you know, talking, and she's sobering up, and she's crying. And she says, you know, I just don't know if I can stay sober. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't, you know, she said, I don't have a job. Now, by not passing the bar, I couldn't get a job because, you know, you can't be a lawyer because you didn't pay. I go, well, I don't either. She said, but, you know, I don't even know if I have enough money to pay next month's rent. I go, you know, I don't either. She's like, how long have you been sober? I was like, 11 years. It's a good program. And most people are really doing pretty well. But here's the thing. At the end of the day, this is all about sobriety. We stay sober no matter what. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't guarantee me a job, a car, that my kids are going to go to college, you know, anything else. It's like, I get to stay sober. And it talks about in the beginning of the 12 and 12, one of my favorite, you know, passages that I've been thinking about is it says that the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are a set of spiritual principles designed to help the sufferer be free of a compulsion to drink and to be happily and happy and to live a happy and useful life. And I like the part that happily is in there. I really do. You know, it's not like a big, you know, I got to just do this and, you know, get through it, although sometimes that's the best I can do. You know, and I'm very grateful to the people who, you know, come around and kind of push me along. There was this guy in history named Dr. Jung who made a contribution to Alcoholics Anonymous in the early days. And one of the things that he did was he told one of the members before they ever met Bill Wilson or Ebby that the only recovery he'd ever seen possible from alcoholism was a psychic change that had to be very profound. And he was a man of science, and that's what he wrote. Bill wrote him many years later, Bill Wilson wrote him, to thank him for that contribution that had eventually led into the finding that we have of, you know, the spiritual experience and that chapter, that part that's written in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. But Dr. Jung wrote back and he said, you know, thank you for your letter. He said, but I don't even think a psychic change is enough. He said, I just want to mention. He said, I think it also requires a community. I think that the people that I've seen that have had a successful recovery have also had a community. And I believe in that very much. I am not one of the people that have had an easy spiritual journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm very grateful that they wrote in C that God couldn't would if he were sought. I'm interested. I'm keeping an open mind. I like learning things. I've had different times where I felt very close to a conscious contact and an understanding, and other times where I felt very far away and I didn't quite understand at all. And I've been able to rely in those times upon the group of Alcoholics Anonymous that we are doing something that I know is not possible for someone like me. When I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, there was a guy who talked a lot. His name was Norm Alpe. I encourage you to get a tape if you ever have a chance. But for me, Norm Alpe was the best speaker I ever heard, and every time I ever heard him, I thought, I want to join Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I'd remember I already belonged, or I wouldn't have been there hearing him. You know. But I really have found, for me, that what Norm would always talk about was he would say, you know, but for the grace of God, rooms like this, people like you, I could have missed it all. Thanks for not letting me.